I'm Christopher Lydon with Andrew Bacevich, the soldier-turned-writer who is still unlearning and puncturing the Washington rules of national security. The rules have turned into doctrines, he'll tell you, of global war forever. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Andrew Bacevich's career as a U.S. Army officer ran from West Point to Vietnam to the first Gulf War in 1991. The short form of his story for us is how unexamined failure in Vietnam led by today to a sort of repetition compulsion in Iraq and Afghanistan. Washington Rules is Andrew Bacevich's fourth book in a project to unmask American empire, militarism, overreach, and what sustains them. We are speaking in his office at Boston University. The form of your book is a story about scales falling from your own eyes as a professional military guy in his early middle age. My thought is, if you can learn these lessons in that position, we all can. What did Vietnam have to do with it in retrospect? What did the actuality of the first Gulf War have to do with it? What did Iraq have to do with it?
Well, I think of all those conflicts that you just ticked off, the one that was, I think, most important in shaping my current view of things was probably the Iraq War of 2003. I found the Bush administration's arguments that invading Iraq was an imperative to be implausible. I thought that choosing war against Saddam Hussein at that juncture, and it was a war of choice, represented the absolute height of recklessness. And I believed that the arrogance of senior American officials with regard to what they thought was the capacity of American military power was incredibly foolish and incredibly dangerous. And of course, they and we got our comeuppance when the war that they launched with such confidence turned into such an awful mess.
So when did the skeleton appear of this book? The fundamental notion that the United States has to run the world and that we got to do it by a global presence, by assertion of power at many, many levels, and by fairly regular interventions. I mean, this is the doctrine that you identify at the core of things. When did this appear?
The Washington Rules, as I try to identify them, including, first of all, an insistence, I call it the American credo, an insistence that the United States is called upon to lead, shape, liberate, transform the world. And then, at least as troubling, a belief that a certain military playbook provides the way to fulfill the claims in the American credo. And that playbook based on the conviction that we should maintain a global military presence, that we should configure our forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments of power projection. And then finally, that we should marry this global presence and these power projection capabilities together to support a policy of global interventionism. The argument really is that's what we have done since 9/11, but we've done it since 9/11 because that's what we were doing before 9/11.
Mm.
The difference is before 9/11, for perhaps some period of time, the Washington Rules may kind of, sort of, have worked. Since 9/11, it seems crystal clear to me that they don't work. And indeed, they are exacerbating the problems that we face, both in the realm of security and also, I think, in the fiscal realm, because we're wasting so much money.
I have a maybe irrational notion that everybody, if they thought about it, would reach your conclusions. That there's an impatience here that runs from Congressman Ron Paul on the right and Pat Buchanan and a lot of people to
to people like Kevin Phillips, formerly of the right, or the late Susan Sontag, or Norman Mailer, or even Noam Chomsky, there's a kind of common sense, it's not working reflex that we do everything but act on. How do we get to that wake up moment? How did you get there? How does the country get there?
You know, it's funny the way you say it that way, because I frequently encounter people and they say, "I really like what you write because what you write is what I've been thinking all along." And I'm never quite sure if I should take that as a compliment or not, because it makes me feel like, I guess, my whatever ideas I'm expressing aren't quite all that original. On the other hand, I think it really does suggest, and I truly believe, that there is this spreading awareness among ordinary people that there really is something fundamentally amiss, that we have somehow, somewhere, gone down a wrong path, and this path is headed to the cliff. Where the cliff is, nobody knows, but that there's something fundamentally amiss. What I haven't been able to figure out is why that awareness has not translated into an effective political response. I think I figured out why Washington hasn't picked up on the problem. I mean, I argue in this new book that Washington is committed to the Washington rules because the Washington rules benefit Washington, that there is money to be made, there are prerogatives to be exercised, there is glory to be won in adhering to the Washington rules. And so even though they're not making the country safer or helping us become richer, Washington wants to play this game out as long as it possibly can. But to the extent that those of us who are not part of Washington have come to recognize that the Washington rules don't work, why isn't there a political response in what is ostensibly a democratic country?
Not only that, but an so-called anti-Washington culture. We say we don't trust Washington, and yet this rule prevails.
I think that's a further good point. The only speculative answer I have is that this understanding that we've gone down the wrong path is an intellectual understanding. Mm-hmm. But we ordinary folk have not, most of us, really paid the price yet. Mm-hmm. Were we to pay the price, were the consequences of our actions as a country to come home, then I think maybe people would demand a change. Now, why don't the consequences come home? Two reasons. The first is the abandonment of the citizen-soldier tradition so that the country can find itself in a condition akin to perpetual war, where the burden of service and sacrifice is imposed on a very, very small percentage of the American people, and the rest of us really are cast in the role of spectators. And the second reason that we haven't felt the consequences is that, especially since 9/11, we have refused to pay for the wars that are waged in our name. The Bush administration, I think, in perhaps its most single cynical act, was to embark upon what people in the Bush administration said was a open-ended global war on the one hand, and at the same time to provide tax cuts for the American people. Mm. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt took us into World War II, Franklin Roosevelt was quite explicit in saying, this is an important enterprise, and implementing this enterprise is going to cause us to make short-term sacrifices. We are going to have a draft, and we are going to raise taxes to share the burden, but also the generation in whose behalf war is being waged would be a generation that would assume not total, but substantial responsibility for bearing the costs. We've not done that since 9/11. And I think that that may well explain why an intellectual understanding of something, that something is amiss, without a substantial political response.
Andrew Basevich, you're a West Point graduate. You're a senior officer in the Army. My guess has always been that there are lots of guys like you, certainly in the reflective ranks, the service academies, the general staffs, especially the ones that lived through Vietnam, the Colin Powell generation, shall we say. Why don't we hear more from them? Why did they put up with Rumsfeld? Why have the revisionists on military performance, on the post-World War II history, not caught hold?
The Colin Powell generation did draw very well-defined conclusions from Vietnam. What they concluded was that they never again wished to see the American military thrust into this long, drawn-out, ambiguous kind of conflict in which they lacked public support. And the Colin Powell generation after Vietnam redesigned U.S. forces in a way that tried to optimize them as instruments of conventional war, with the expectation that conventional wars would be relatively infrequent, and with the intention of waging them — this gets to the overwhelming force notion — of waging them in ways that they would be short and end in a decisive outcome, with an exit strategy, to use Powell's phrase, already identified. And indeed, those were the expectations that accompanied the intervention, the invasion of Iraq in 2003. General Tommy Franks was the commander. Shock and awe was his paradigm. The march to Baghdad seemed to go swimmingly well. The fall of Baghdad was thought to end the conflict, hence President Bush's famous speech in front of the banner that said, that declared, mission accomplished. All of those expectations turned out to be false. I think one of the most remarkable and underappreciated aspects of the whole post 9/11 military enterprise is the way that the officer corps, the present day officer corps, has turned its back on the lessons devised by people like Colin Powell. And they did so in reviving counterinsurgency doctrine as the primary American way of war, even though in doing so, they in essence declared that victory was no longer the aim of going to war. You know, we've heard people like General David Petraeus say repeatedly, with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan, there is no military option. War has now become this kind of shapeless enterprise. Nobody thinks that a decisive battle is going to produce a decisive victory. Rather, the expectations are that at best, somehow over a long period of time, some kind of concerted civil-military effort will bring into existence some set of institutions, you know, an Afghan government, an Afghan army, that may at some future date, way out there down the road,
way out there,
enable U.S. forces to gradually begin to disengage. So that the fear of the Colin Powell generation of long, drawn-out, amorphous, problematic wars has become the reality that the present generation of officers have embraced as their destiny. They believe, the current generation believes, that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan constitute the template for what future American wars are going to look like. And it is astonishing to someone of my generation that they would so willingly accept that as their fate. But they have.
Of course, this was the Orwell nightmare, too, that war would be far enough away with people that we knew just little enough that it would just be this kind of background white noise.
Well, I think it was Orwell's fear. It was Robert McNamara's hope, in a way. Early in the Vietnam War, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara at one point uttered the hope that Vietnam would be the occasion when Americans would learn to go to war in cold blood, would come to see war as not abnormal but normal. Mm. Now, he got it totally wrong on Vietnam. But in a sense, his hope and expectation has ironically come to pass in our own day, that Americans don't seem to be particularly disconcerted by the fact that, you know, we've been engaged in war in Afghanistan now, what, 9 years?
Mm.
And oddly enough, the senior military leadership doesn't seem to be particularly disconcerted by that idea. And indeed, our president, whom we elected because he was the anti-Iraq candidate and the candidate who said he was going to change the way Washington works, comes in office and escalates and prolongs the Afghanistan war. He doesn't seem to be particularly disconcerted by how long this enterprise drags on.
Of course, this is the substance of this book of yours, Washington Rules. I'd paraphrase it as a kind of question of how revisionism on a terrible, terrible failure in Vietnam, failure of planning, failure of execution too probably, failure of strategy, failure of world understanding, how the revisionism on Vietnam became a kind of repetition compulsion everywhere. Is there a short form on how we went this far without learning still the lesson of Vietnam?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. I'm not sure I can give a good explanation. I mean, I guess we're more or less the same age. But, I mean, we are of a generation, I think, that believed that the Vietnam War marked a breakpoint in American history, that this was a watershed event, it seemed at the time. I certainly believe that. And what strikes me is, in retrospect, what stands out is how little things changed as a consequence of Vietnam. I don't mean that nothing changed. I mean, it was as a consequence of Vietnam that we abandoned the citizen-soldier tradition and embraced this notion of a professional military. Not a trivial change by any means. But what didn't happen after Vietnam is a ground-up reassessment of the premises undergirding U.S. national security policy.
Mm.
I mean, what's striking is that if the fall of Saigon happened in 1975, by 1980, we elect Ronald Reagan president. His election, signifying a repudiation of Jimmy Carter, and I think by extension, a repudiation of those who were not inclined to embrace the heroic version of Vietnam. Ronald Reagan embraced the heroic version of Vietnam. Ronald Reagan famously declared it an honorable cause. Ronald Reagan insisted that the only reason we'd lost in Vietnam was because Lyndon Johnson wouldn't let the American military win. I mean, those notions played tremendously well. Reagan was telling Americans what they wanted to hear, that Vietnam, in a sense, should not rightly be viewed as a defeat, should not be held against the United States. It was Lyndon Johnson's fault and Robert McNamara's fault. I think that the election of Ronald Reagan signified a shift in the mood of the country that helped then bury the notion that Vietnam had important things to teach.
You and I would probably disagree about Reagan. I thought he was a wilier player than that. He called it a noble cause in retrospect, but he didn't do it again. It was George H.W. Bush who was so eager to, as he kept saying, lick that Vietnam syndrome. Ronald Reagan, I think, was happy to see it over. Sentimentalize it, of course, but not do it again. I think he would never have gone near Iraq. when he did get bruised in the Middle East and when the Marines got blown up in Beirut, we were out of there, pal. We're going to go and beat up Grenada.
Well, I'm not sure we disagree as much as you think, because I think we're talking two different things here. You're talking about his actual willingness to employ force, and certainly if we compare Reagan's willingness, we can compare Reagan's willingness to use force to Clinton's willingness to use force. Clinton was far more
absolutely
inclined to use force. But I'm not talking about willingness to use force. I'm talking about the rewriting of history and the rewriting of the history of the Vietnam War in Reagan's myth-making that created obstacles to understanding the Vietnam War, its causes, the reasons for its failures, so that we might have embarked upon a different course afterwards. We didn't embark upon a different course.
Your book reminds me that the revision on Vietnam went very, very deep for a while. William Fulbright, senator from Arkansas, was a much more radical critic than I had realized reading your book. And the Marine General David Shoup, commandant of the Marines, was way, way out there, like, bring them home. Nobody's going to threaten us, etc. And yet all of that wisdom seemed to get swallowed up in the official Anthony Lake high-level committee reconsideration. How did that opportunity get missed?
Well, I'm not trying to make it sound like a conspiracy, because it's not a conspiracy. But I think there is a mindset. In order to gain entrance into the national security elite, it is all but necessary to subscribe to a set of propositions. And whether you're a Democrat or you're a Republican or you're a professional military officer, in order to be treated seriously, you need to subscribe to these propositions. And those propositions include maintaining a global military presence, being willing to use force on the other side of the world, spending exorbitant amounts of money on the Pentagon, refusing to demand accountability when weapons programs end up costing orders of magnitude more than they're supposed to, or accountability when a particular intervention goes sour. This national security elite after Vietnam was determined to preserve and restore the Washington rules.
Right.
And they succeeded in doing so. Now, why did they succeed in doing so? I think one of the things one cannot underestimate is the inclination on the part of the American people to defer to Washington on issues related to national security, to work on the assumption that these smart people with access to classified information must know things that you and I as citizens can't know. You referred earlier in our discussion to the anti-Washington mood of the moment, that there is a great mistrust of Washington on issues of taxes or domestic policy. Somehow that mistrust doesn't fully extend into the realm of national security policy.
Even
today, as we speak, when the Tea Party is all the rage, even today, as the Obama administration is moving into, much, much more deeply into, what is an ongoing U.S. military intervention in Yemen, of all places in the world, there's remarkably little discussion about whether this is a good idea or a bad idea.
But what about the professionals? We read all of the military cult of lessons learned. I've read Colonel McMaster's book on dereliction of duty about the screw-up between the White House and the Pentagon, the failure of military officers to say we know better about Vietnam, the ones who didn't speak up. And yet, when I talked to him, he was on his way to Iraq to join the Petraeus team on repeating it. There are lots of instances out there of very smart people in your original profession who know better, but again, can't seem to get a foothold. Why does this happen?
I think it's exceedingly difficult for someone who is embedded in an institutional framework to be able to break free of that framework. Moving myself out of that framework enabled me to begin to ask different questions that I never would have asked before, and to come up with answers that probably would have seemed to be unacceptable before. So to expect a senior serving professional officer to challenge orthodoxy asks a whole lot.
It does ask a whole lot, but it seems to me that comes to the question for all of us. My standard, in a way, is set by Louis Menand's book called The Metaphysical Club. And it's an interesting contrast, it seems to me, over a 100-year period, 1860s to the 1960s. And the contrasting figures in my reading are Otto Wendell Holmes, Jr., who left Harvard to go in the first volunteers to the Civil War for Lincoln, severely wounded, came back a different man. John Kerry, early volunteer to Vietnam, wounded three times, not so severely, but came back and seemed to forget what he'd seen. In the case of the Civil War veterans and the intellectuals around them, there was a real rethinking of that experience. It invented what's known as the American philosophy, pragmatism, William James. If it doesn't work, it's not a good idea. I'm still waiting, and I think you are too, for a kind of national inquiry, a serious one, about intervention abroad, and it would have to start very belatedly now with Vietnam, but I think it's one of those big hungers that the whole country shares. We're not an imperial people. It's not in our DNA. It's not in our history. It's not in our intellectual tradition. It hasn't worked. It works less and less each time we do it, it seems to me. How do we begin to get over it is my puzzle.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think the country does hunger for that reflection. I wish it did. You hunger for it. I hunger for it.
I think Ronald Reagan
Vietnam is slipped into our past now and has become a mythic event. But I feel much the same hunger or disappointment with regard to the Iraq War, an event that is much nearer to us in time, that ostensibly is now coming to an end, that I think is widely understood to be either a monstrous mistake or, at a minimum, an enterprise that was undertaken for perhaps honest reasons, but then was mismanaged throughout. One would think that, as we end the U.S. combat role in Iraq, that there would be some sort of a national period of reflection, an inquiry, an effort to say, well, what happened and why and with what consequences and what should we take from this experience? The reality, it seems to me, is that the vast majority of Americans are just eager to put the war in their rearview mirror and move on and forget about it. Again, I deeply regret the fact that that's the case, but it seems to me quite clear that that's the case. Note, for example, the contrast between ourselves and the British people. In Britain, there was this demand for questions and answers, and that produced their so-called Chilcot inquiry, this official inquiry into the origins and conduct of Britain's Iraq War, televised, widely reported, senior officials summoned to answer the questions put to them by a panel of distinguished Brits. And you have to ask yourself, why can't we do that? Why don't we do that? But the fact of the matter is, we don't. And it seems that there's not enough interest in having that sort of an exercise in accountability to cause political elites actually to move in that direction.
I don't quite agree with your picture of the Americans. I think if you analyze the Tea Party deep enough, if you held them on the couch long enough, you'd find that one of the nightmares down there, when they talk about accountability, transparency, you know, fiscal sanity, etc., is this sort of hot stove of our modern wars.
Yeah, but they're just angry. I mean, I understand the source of their anger, but that anger doesn't translate into anything that's coherent.
Well, now,
even back in the Vietnam War, certainly there was never going to be we did have, to some degree, we had official inquiries because we had people like Senator Fulbright conducting very serious hearings in the venue of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It didn't, to some degree, were exercises in theater, but even as exercises in theater, they manifested some fairly deep-seated and certainly impassioned desire to get to the truth of things. I see no interest in getting to the truth of the Iraq War, at least none that, again, that results in meaningful political action. And what I get from the Tea Party is, yeah, they're really mad. But
but sometimes with an angry person, you have to sit him down and say, now, cool off, pal. Let's talk about it. And he says, but they're taxing me too much. No, wait a sec. Let's think about it. Is that really what's bugging you? And it might take a year of therapy. It might take a long conversation.
Well, obviously, I'm afraid that the influencers of the Tea Party movement are not people who say let's reflect. They are people who say you're darn right, you're mad, and you should be, and it's all Obama's fault.
He's probably not an American anyway.
True, and I mean, so the Tea Party movement, I think, is as a expression of American anger, is simply being exploited by people who are themselves probably not angry, but think that the Tea Party provides a mechanism to gain some kind of a political advantage. We'll see if they're right or not.
Some of the continuities that you write about in the book, Andrew Bacevich, are shocking. I'd never seen that line before from McGeorge Bundy after the Viet Cong attack on Pleiku, which, how many American lives were lost? 8 or 10?
Roughly, yeah.
But it became an occasion for a big escalation, and McGeorge Bundy actually wrote, Pleikus are like streetcars. You have to be ready to hop on and make the most of it.
Well, and they're like streetcars in the sense that if you don't hop on this one, you'd have to be patient because another pretext will present itself to do what you want to do.
Was 9/11 really, in your view, a streetcar that the Bush White House, Rumsfeld, Cheney, et cetera, jumped on?
I think to a considerable degree, yes. And I don't mean that they conjured up 9/11 and that there's some conspiracy. I don't buy that at all. But I think that the people within the administration, I suspect this is less true of President Bush, more true of people like Vice President Cheney and Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. They were quick to see in tragedy and disaster opportunity. The opportunity that they wasted no time in seizing upon was the notion that here was the opportunity to unleash American military superiority to fix a big problem. And the big problem they thought they were going to fix was dysfunction in the Islamic world, dysfunction that had manifested itself in authoritarian dictatorships like that of Saddam Hussein, but also dysfunction that manifested itself in Islamic radicalism, whether the form that we see in the Islamic Republic of Iran or in the form that we see in Al-Qaeda. And these people, incredibly recklessly and foolishly and stupidly, thought that we possessed sufficient hard power to sort the problems of the Islamic world out. I think to me that's the answer. The people ask the question, well, Saddam Hussein didn't plan 9/11. He had nothing to do with it. So why'd they go after Saddam Hussein? Some people say, well, the answer is obvious. It's oil. I think, no, the answer is obvious that they thought that toppling Saddam and fixing Iraq, fixing in their minds, really was going to open the door to this larger project of transformation. And that what made Iraq so inviting was not that Saddam Hussein posed a great threat to the United States. He didn't pose any threat at all. What made Iraq so inviting was it was supposed to be easy. Saddam was weak. You know, he'd been subjected to a decade worth of sanctions. Mm. His army was pathetic back in 1991, and it was weaker still in 2003. So it was going to be a quick victory, they thought. and they were wrong.
How do we keep from being the last to know about our own predicament, our own incapacity, our own lack of understanding in the world? I mean, this gets a little scary.
We don't particularly want to face up to the facts. The facts stare us in the face.
Recite them.
At the present, well, one fact is trillion-dollar federal deficits. We're into the second year of trillion-dollar deficits. If I'm not mistaken, as we speak, the national debt is now above $13 trillion. The GDP is about $14 trillion. There really is no end in sight to these deficits and to this growing indebtedness. There are any number of economists who now say that this is a problem, this is unsustainable. And yet, Americans, apart from Tea Party people, aren't demanding that this be addressed. Certainly our political class is not taking any effective action to address this problem. So it's not as if we don't know. I mean, the second fact is we've got too much war, too few warriors. We send our soldiers for 3, 4, 5 combat tours. You know, the notion that we are going to be able to pacify the Islamic world is clearly unrealistic. I'm not a pacifist, but the security problems we face, for those security problems, war is not the answer. I think it's self-evident. And yet, even somebody as smart as President Obama can't take on board the implications of recognizing that war is not the answer. Instead, we elect this very bright, smart guy president, and his first major national security decision is one that finds him escalating a war, prolonging a war, in the same month that he's receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think the contradictions are of gaping proportions. We just refuse to acknowledge them. We would prefer to cover our eyes and muddle through. And so it's like Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind, you know? If I just say loudly enough that tomorrow will be a better day, maybe it will be. I mean, my guess is that when Barack Obama crawls in bed at night and thinks about Afghanistan, he doesn't say, boy, did I make a good decision. I suspect he crawls in bed at night and says, my God, what did I get myself into?
I read your book imagining Obama reading it, and I can imagine him nodding, yeah, gosh, of course. Well, on almost every page.
I have no evidence that he's read the book, so I don't know how he would respond to it. But I think we need to recognize that even smart political people are constrained. They are constrained by institutions. They are constrained by habits. I think that's the case with this president. I think we have to recognize that being a smart president probably means to recognize you've got limited chips to play. You have to set your priorities, what you think you can get done. I think this president chose consciously to put his chips on a domestic agenda for his first term and chose to kick the can down the road in terms of national security issues. I think that was a bad mistake, but I think that's what he chose to do. And I think having kicked that can down the road, he's never going to be able to deal with it. I think if the president were going to make major changes in national security policy, the Afghanistan decision offered him the opportunity to begin that process. And having chosen to escalate the Afghanistan war, I think he, in effect, embraced the Washington rules, embraced the established playbook and routines, and he stuck with them.
Andy Basevich, you quote David Petraeus' question to, I guess, a CNN reporter in Iraq, saying, remind me, how does this come out?
Tell me how this ends, he said.
Yeah. Tell us how it ends.
Well, I think it's going to end in further tragedy and more catastrophe. We failed to adequately reflect on the Vietnam experience, perhaps because it divided the country so bitterly. It was difficult by the end of the Vietnam War to have a civil conversation about the Vietnam War. I think to some degree we're repeating that now with respect to the Iraq War. I think it is very important, regardless of what you think about the origins of the Iraq War, the conduct of the Iraq War, or the outcome of the Iraq War. I think it would be profoundly important for us as a people to reflect on this experience and to draw some meaning from it. It's not going to happen. The president himself, President Obama, when he announced the end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq, said quite explicitly that the time has come to turn the page. That was his phrase, to turn the page on Iraq. And I think that's what we're going to do, and I deeply regret that. We will continue, I think, to overvalue military power. We will continue to believe that military power provides some all-purpose instrument, a preferred instrument, the American strong suit. We will continue to believe that the world is plastic, that it's malleable. We will continue to believe that the word freedom really means what you and I understand to be freedom. We will refuse to acknowledge that the aspirations of other peoples and indeed the definition of freedom to which other people subscribe might be different than our own. I think because of our refusal to look facts in the face and deal with the consequences, our refusal to act consistent with that pragmatism that you cited as an American way of thinking, we're no longer pragmatic. I think there's big trouble ahead.
Andy Basevich, it's a pleasure to read your books and to feel a terrific mind at work, and I must say, always a life in progress. This is exciting and depressing too, but exciting all the while. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited our conversation with Andrew Basevich. His book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Do you buy it? Do you want to push back? The exchange isn't over until listeners leap in with comments at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining the conversation.